Hello, and welcome to a special edition of McLean's on the Hill, recorded from the City News Studios in Toronto. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. The McLean's Leaders Debate has wrapped up, and it was an energetic, passionate, and sometimes aggressive event. All four major national party leaders duked it out in the first debate of this election campaign. Despite the feisty arguments, there's no clear winner. Now, in this special edition of McLean's on the Hill, we will be bringing you highlights from the political battle and letting you hear some of the best exchanges between the leaders. We also have a special McLean's panel to break down the performances of the leaders and analyze the arguments. And McLean's associate editor Aaron Wherry tells us his takeaways from the first political bout and what homework the leaders have to do moving forward in the campaign. For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill. While the dust is settling after a hard-hitting McLean's Leaders Debate, at the City News Studios in Toronto, the four major national party leaders, Conservative leader Stephen Harper, the NDP's Thomas Mulcair, Liberal Justin Trudeau, and Elizabeth May of the Greens, all faced off for the first time in this federal election. The leaders were prepared for a fight, and when the bell rung, the gloves did come off. It's clear the incumbent Stephen Harper was enemy number one, even though it's Thomas Mulcair who's leading in the polls. Now, after opening statements, the moderator, McLean's political editor Paul Wells, kicked off the debate on the subject of the economy, which hasn't been doing so well as of late. We've had five straight months of negative growth, a technical recession is on the horizon, and there are reports the Conservatives no longer have the numbers to balance the books as promised. Right off the bat, it was a pylon as leaders like Mulcair ripped into Harper's economic management.
Stephen Harper is the only prime minister in Canadian history who, when asked about the recession during his mandate, gets to say, which one? He's just admitted that we've had 5 months of negative growth in a row. And yes, a lot of experts say we already are in a recession. Mr. Harper, we want to spend our time concentrating on creating jobs for Canadians. What we're seeing here tonight is that you're going to do everything you can to hang on to your job. I'm going to do everything I can to create jobs.
Now, Harper tried to defend himself by reviewing his record and attacking the opposition policies like those of Liberal leader Justin Trudeau.
We have 1.3 million net new jobs created since the global financial crisis, the best record by far in the G7. That's why incomes are rising across the board in this country and have been rising. That's why we have manufacturing and other sectors outside of energy that are now expanding because we are able, because we have a balanced budget and are able to make investments in things like infrastructure, in healthcare, in benefits for families. Now is not the time to throw us back into deficit and to start to spend tens of billions of dollars we don't have paid for by tax hikes.
That is the wrong policy. The reality is Canadians across this country know that times are tough. And the fact is you have completely become disconnected from the reality that people are facing right across the country. Your plan isn't working, and we know that, and the risk would be sticking with your plan.
And the gang up on Harper didn't end. The next topic was energy and the environment, where the Conservative record was once again put to the test by the other leaders. The Green Party's Elizabeth May took aim, and in this clip you can hear May scoff and sigh at the defense put forward by Harper.
The cold, cruel reality is that under your watch, greenhouse gases have been rising, carbon pollution has been rising as soon as our economy began to recover in 2009. Straight up line.
Well,
straight up.
Greenhouse gas emissions have actually gone down, and the economy has actually grown. Those are the facts. Mr. Mulcair says the projects, various energy projects, are going nowhere. No, they are all in an environmental process that is going forward. We make sure that we look at that process and make decisions. The problem is that the other parties have taken positions, depending on who they're speaking to, in Mr. Trudeau's case, against every single one of these projects. By the way, not just oil projects, but in British Columbia,
that's not true,
against
Mr. Harper.
Natural gas projects.
But it was after all of this, the debate began to shift. Trudeau and Mulcair appeared to perform the best during the first half, and to kick off the second half, we saw them square off against each other over the issue of Quebec separation. Now, the NDP has supported the 50% plus one approach for referendum results if Quebec wants to leave Canada. While the Liberals have criticized this, they haven't clarified what the result numbers would have to be for them to recognize an independent Quebec. So when the issue popped up, Mulcair knew who to target.
Now, I can understand it's a bit frustrating for the Liberals that for the first time in a full generation, Quebecers voted massively for a Federalist Party and they wanted nothing to do with the Liberals. And it's easy to understand why. You just heard it. The only two people I know in Canada who are anxious to start talking about separatism again are Justin Trudeau and Gilles Duceppe. Mr. Trudeau has an obligation, if he wants to talk about this subject, to come clean with Canadians. What's his number? What is your number, Mr. Trudeau?
First of all, Mr. Mulcair, I don't question your patriotism.
You have an answer.
The question is, why is your policy so reckless? You want a number, Mr. Mulcair?
Give us
a number. 9. My number is 9. 9 Supreme Court justices said one vote is not enough to break up this country. And yet that is Mr. Mulcair's position. He wants to be prime minister of this country, and he's choosing to side with the separatist movement in Quebec and not with the Supreme Court of Canada.
Now that sparked a passionate response from Conservative Stephen Harper, who actually, in a rare move, sided with his Liberal rival to target Mulcair.
Look, I'm not going to question Mr. Mulcair's position as a longtime Federalist. That is clear. What I think I do question, along with Mr. Trudeau, is why bring up a debate of the Clarity Act other than to satisfy the separatist elements within the NDP in Quebec? Nobody's talking about that. You know, we just had Quebecers massively reject that agenda. Nobody wants to raise this. Why would we go down the route of talking about how we can best break up the country when, in fact, Quebecers clearly do not want to do that?
But soon after, Harper was put right back in the hot seat, with moderator Paul Wells putting the Conservative leader on the spot over the Senate.
Mr. Harper, you used to promise that you wouldn't name senators if they hadn't been elected. Now you're promising you won't name senators at all. You blame the courts for blocking reform, and you've asked the provinces to come up with ideas for reform. But the courts and the provinces didn't name the senators who are in trouble. You did. Do you owe Canadians an apology for putting Mike Duffy, Pamela Wallin, and Patrick Brazeau in the Senate?
Well, first of all, I certainly did not name all of the senators that are in trouble. You know, the Senate has been an institution that has these kinds of problems for 150 years. I'd say for the first time, we actually have a Senate that now has clear rules and is enforcing those rules. What I will say is this, Paul. My role is not to apologize for the bad actions of others. When bad actions arise, the role of a leader is to take responsibility and hold people accountable, and that's exactly what we're doing.
While Harper was the subject of many attacks, he held his own throughout the debate and finished strong on the theme of foreign policy and national security. While the other leaders criticized Canada's involvement in the mission against ISIS, Harper mounted a strong argument to take down the terrorist group.
Virtually all of the countries of the region, a Muslim region, support this. The reason they support this is this organization has become the global nerve center of a violent jihadist movement that is not only threatening, literally slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and Syria before we intervened, but is a threat to the entire region and a threat to the entire globe. It has singled out Canada and Canadians by name and has demonstrated the ability to carry out attacks in countries like ours. It would be absolutely foolish for us not to go after this group before they come after us.
The Conservative leader faced additional attacks from the Greens' Elizabeth May on the controversial new anti-terror laws.
There is no expert oversight of C-51. There's no oversight at all. And if you listen to security experts, and I urge anyone watching to go online and find the evidence of Joe Fogarty, who is an MI5 agent from the UK doing liaison intelligence work with Canada, this C-51 Anti-Terrorism Act makes us less safe. It is not confronting terrorism. It is very likely to make us less able to disrupt plots while at the same time eroding our freedoms.
But through the attacks, Harper continued to defend himself by trying to clearly lay out his position.
Security and freedom go hand in hand. We know that the international jihadist movement that we face is a very serious menace to this planet, including to this country. What we did in developing our legislation is we looked at what modern powers police and security agencies have across our allies, and we made sure that we are up to those standards. We've also provided, Mr. Trudeau talks about oversight, we have moved our oversight in a very different direction, not having politicians do oversight. We have oversight done by independent experts, by people who are experts in the field, an independent committee, and they are chaired by prominent former judges.
After all the punches were thrown, leaders once again made an appeal to voters in their closing statements, and then they all left the stage. Now, normally all party leaders move to a scrum area where waiting journalists get the chance to toss questions at them and quiz them on their performance and policies. While three of the leaders took part in this tradition, Conservative leader Stephen Harper decided to skip it, not taking any further questions after the two-hour bout. To analyze the performance of the leaders, we have a unique Maclean's panel. Right after the debate ended, City News aired a post-debate special, which included a panel consisting of myself, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, and Justin Ling from Vice. The panel was hosted by Cynthia Mulligan from City News, and she began by asking me what I thought about Mulcair really hitting his stride on the issue of the environment.
Cormac, your thoughts?
Well, I think at the start of the debate, Mulcair was trying too hard. He was probably told how to look, how to act, how to smile.
Looking into the camera too much.
Way
yeah,
too
definitely.
Much smiling.
Yes.
Way too much.
So it came off as kind of fake almost in a way. He was trying a little bit too hard. And then I think he dropped that as he got a little bit later into the debate, and he started to become the Mulcair we actually know and see in question period, as John was mentioning a little bit earlier. And that's when he really hit his stride. That's when he really started to go after people, yet also make his point effective and get his message across.
Yeah, Mulcair's a nerd at the end of the day. He wants to be able to stand up there and recite you the most intricate levels of policy and the most intricate levels of his experience and his research and everything he's crammed into his big egg head. And that's what he got to do there. And he got to stand up and he got to clobber the Prime Minister by saying, you failed here, you failed here, you failed here. And he got to make a very coherent point in that we should be keeping energy jobs here in Canada rather than exporting them to China or the U.S.
Did you see the exasperated look on Harper's face, though, as he looked over at Mulcair? That's to me, that's sort of a classic sort of thing about their relationship, eh? Mulcair hammering, Harper looking, oh, Lord, not this guy again.
So there was a really interesting exchange between Trudeau and Mulcair on national unity where Mulcair was goading Trudeau. Interesting moment. Some fireworks.
Couple Montrealers
going at it.
They feel the stuff in their marrow bone. Eh? Mm-hmm. It's mother's milk.
Yeah. Well, what Trudeau got to do here, he got to play very specifically to Montrealers and Ontarians, especially those who lived through the last two referendums. And Harper then got to jump in and say, let's not even bother talking about
talking
this. And let's
Harper's
move on.
Best
and yet,
moments, I think.
I think that was his best segment, and he was passionate about the unity question, and he really came through on that.
Now let's not talk about this.
We have so much more to talk about. We haven't even covered off Elizabeth May yet. How articulate she was.
She was really good, and I think we knew that she had a good ability at effectively getting her point across, but as I think John had mentioned earlier, that sometimes Elizabeth May tends to ramble. She was prepared. She was on point. She kept her answers short. She attacked. She brought up a lot of examples. She proved what she was trying to say and get across, and then she really effectively got her message.
And smartly, she went after Mulcair in B.C. She made some specific points against him, especially
on the pipeline.
I think what she did tonight, she didn't prove her. She didn't prove that she should be Prime Minister, which she proved that she should have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 MPs.
And one little ouch moment to tell the audience about, a little Twitter gaffe or a social media gaffe from the Prime Minister's office.
Cormac, you were looking at it, weren't you?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to come out and declare that the Prime Minister has won this debate, and it's a little bit embarrassing when you misspell the word Prime Minister.
I've
been known to make spelling mistakes on Twitter, so I'm hesitant to leap too much on this.
Now, I did take a look at the Twitter account again. They have fixed the spelling
hastily
error.
Hastily fixed.
Yes, very
but
quickly.
But still a little bit of an embarrassment.
Yeah. Yes. Obviously.
And I mean, Harper all night was facing a lot of attacks.
We know it is an embarrassment. So. The fact that the Prime Minister is not speaking to reporters after this event, and that is actually, for me, unconscionable. All of the other leaders are standing out there and asking questions about how they did, about their policies, about their platform, about what they support and believe in. And Stephen Harper just took off, and it's a part of a long series of tactics the Prime Minister's had to avoid the media and to not take questions.
He can't control the crowd.
He can't control the crowd. He can't control the questions they're asking. He can't control what they want to ask him, and so he just runs.
And yet, there he was having a pretty good night. Just one thing I want to mention as we're talking about Harper. Remember in 2011 how what we all said after the debate was it was odd how he did not engage with the other leaders. He refused to look at them. He would only engage with the camera or occasionally the moderator. He didn't do that this time, eh?
He was looking over onto his podium.
We had quite often had cameras where we saw him very directly watching, even watching when the exchanges were between the other leaders. None of that sort of aloofness. He's either was just more relaxed today, or their interpretation of the way it went over last time was that it wasn't a winner for him to seem that distant or detached.
All right. Recent polls suggest Canadians are tired of Stephen Harper and want to change. Do you think he changed anyone's minds?
No. What he did is reinforced the 30-odd percent that were already seriously looking at him and considering voting for him. He didn't scare any of them away. I don't think any of them are going to switch allegiances tomorrow morning. But he certainly didn't buy any new voters with tonight, and I don't think there's a chance for him to even do so. What he needed to do was to convince those 30% that changing their votes would be risky, and I think he did that.
He needed the swing voters, who are almost all liberal, to Tory swingers. He's not picking up NDP votes. He needed those people to not write him off. That small segment of voters who moved late in the last campaign and gave a majority that very few of us thought he was going to get, he needs those people to not write him off. And for that, he needed not to seem mean and aloof and detached. And I think he managed that tonight.
And I think moving forward, he's going to have to make some changes to the campaign to try and steal more of those liberal voters over to the conservative side. I don't think he fully achieved that goal tonight. We'll see how he does in the rest of the debates moving forward.
What about Mulcair? Because he's now under scrutiny like never before. People are actually wondering if he could be the prime minister, the first NDP prime minister in this country. Mm. How do you think tonight fared with that?
Well, he did well in a couple files, but what he really needed to do was to convince people that he had the economic vision and the economic plan to get people back to work, and he just didn't do it, I don't think. I don't think he really slam dunked that one. I think Elizabeth May probably sounded more coherent on the economy than Thomas Mulcair did tonight, and I think that's pretty strange. And Justin Trudeau's attacks on him, basically saying your minimum wage raise is going to only help a handful of people, I think that's pretty devastating.
I think for Mulcair, a lot of the challenge is getting that narrative out that he's not a wonk lifetime politician from Quebec, that he's a grandfather now. He alluded to his grandchildren mm-hmm. at one point, that he grew up in a big family. All those soft edge kind of things that they've tried to do with him really largely this year. And I'm not sure he got a lot of that out there. I didn't get the impression that he managed to steer it on to personal experiences as much as I thought he might. I thought Trudeau might try to do that a bit too. Trudeau did allude to being a dad at one point, and I think he'd rather be defined as a father of young children than the son of a famous politician, so that would be his goal in that.
Terror did come up. We knew that it was going to, and we also knew that Harper was going to play the fear factor and talk about how he had to be the one staying the course. He's the best to protect us from global terrorism. And he had an interesting exchange with Trudeau that will run right now, and Harper defending why Canada is involved in the war on terror abroad.
I don't think this government has actually got involved in very many military actions, but we are certainly involved in one now against ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, in Iraq and Syria. And it's not true what Mr. Mulcair says. Not a few NATO allies. All of our NATO allies support this. And not only our NATO allies. Virtually all of the countries of the region, a Muslim region, support this. The reason they support this is this organization has become the global nerve center of a violent jihadist movement that is not only threatening, literally slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and Syria before we intervened, but is a threat to the entire region and a threat to the entire globe. It has singled out Canada and Canadians by name and has demonstrated the ability to carry out attacks in countries like ours. It would be absolutely foolish for us not to go after this group before they come after us.
I thought that was his most real, intense moment.
Yeah, I thought he was very strong there. I thought he was able to look at the other leaders and say, your positions are foolish. And I think Canadians actually buy that. Canadians buy that maybe there is something worthwhile in stopping what is currently probably the biggest genocidal force in the world. I think Canadians remember Rwanda and remember the Liberal leader at the time saying we're not doing enough. And I think Canadians look at this and they buy Harper's lines on this.
It's the sort of issue in which the serving prime minister has an obvious advantage. It's not true of every issue at a debate list, but on these kind of foreign issues, there's a natural tendency for people to want to hear what the sitting prime minister says and give him a fair amount of benefit of the doubt that he's seeing things with a sort of a sober eye. And I think Harper plays that one pretty well. Polls going back to early 2014 have shown he tends to do well, tends to pick up when international news is in the air, doesn't do quite as well when domestic stories are dominating the headlines.
And he set this right at the start when he was standing in front of Rideau Hall. He said this is going to be about two things, the economy and national security. And he's focused on that. He really wanted to hit home with this topic, discussing the mission against ISIS as well as Bill C-51, defending that against the onslaught from the other leaders. But he stood his ground on this, and he was very passionate about it. I think he scored a lot of points, and he also really did spell it out when he said, if you want to be prime minister, you have to make these tough decisions.
That was a good moment of his.
Once again, the panel was moderated by Cynthia Mulligan of City News and included myself, Justin Ling of Vice, and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Finally, we end off this special edition of McLean's on the Hill with my regular co-host of this show, McLean's Associate Editor Aaron Wary. He gives us his thoughts and hands out homework for the leaders. All right, Aaron, it was an exciting debate, but I guess the real question is, after watching all the leaders duke it out on stage with Paul Wells, what are the takeaways from this?
I think I take away a bit for each leader, and then a general sense of where this is going from here. I'll start with Trudeau, who I thought had the most at stake here. A bad performance from him, an embarrassing moment. Any kind of slip up would have looked really, really bad for him and could have been disastrous because of the expectations that have been built up by the Conservative ad campaign that he's not ready to lead. He really needed to avoid confirming that. And I thought, for the most part, he really did exceed that standard. He kept himself in this race. He was assertive. He came out strong. He didn't shrink from the moment. He wasn't beaten cleanly by Mulcair or Harper. I thought he held his own for the most part, and that's, you know, short of a spectacular victory, that's what he needed to do. He needed to show that he was that he could be in this race. For Elizabeth May, I thought it'll be interesting to take away from her, because I suspect she has strengthened her position in terms of her right to be included in the debates, her right to be included in the discussion, and I suspect people will come away impressed by her. Tom Mulcair started off actually quite reserved, quite slow. He seemed to want to sit back and not be too aggressive, not get into too many fights, try to kind of stay out of the fray. I'm not sure that worked for him necessarily, but I thought he got into it more as the debate went on, and I think he probably also came away thinking he had a strong night. And then for the Prime Minister, the incumbent, if you go back and look at tape of him from 2011 and even probably from 2008, he was more of the calm, reassuring one, and he wanted to stay above the fray. And I thought in this case, he wanted to do a bit of that, but he also was much more aggressive than he was in 2011. This was a guy who's not the clear front runner, who's not obviously cruising to a victory here, and he tried to fight, basically. And I think he probably also came away thinking he did fairly well here. And so that kind of leaves us with what in boxing would probably be called a no decision. It's really hard to say that there was a clear winner here. Debates tend to take on a life of their own, and it's a lot of times you don't know what the meaning of the debate was, or what the moment or what it all meant until after a few days of people kind of picking over it and looking at it. But I think this one established how close this election is, how unclear this election is, and set up what is going to be a very competitive 10 weeks. This debate didn't decide the election, but I don't think that's a bad thing by any stretch. I think it sets up the next 2 months quite well.
All right, so we've seen some of the faults. We've seen some good aspects of each leader's performance. What homework do they have to do moving forward?
Well, I think everybody's got to refine their messages and figure out what exactly their messages are. I think it's probably hard in these debates for leaders to keep track of the dueling ideas. They have to attack the other side, and they have to explain their side. And I suspect that all of them will come away thinking that, or maybe not all of them, but to a certain degree, they'll come thinking like, okay, so my attacks need to be sharper in this way, and the arguments for myself need to be sharper in other ways. There was a lot here that wasn't. There are many things that weren't covered, and that's not because it's any shortcoming on the debate or the moderator. I thought Paul did great. It's more a just a simple fact that there is so much to talk about. And those are the things that will probably come to the fore. I mean, if you look at the first half hour on the economy, that could have been a two-hour debate on its own. And so I think they're all going to go back and look at this tape and just try to refine things and just try to get sharper and figure out which advantages they didn't press hard enough this time.
How do you think the debate format really played into a lot of the exchanges that we saw tonight?
I thought it was good in that we got to see these guys clash head to head. They have lots of opportunities to go and make speeches and explain why they're great and the other guys isn't great. And this gave them a chance to actually test each other. And in a lot of ways, I thought they did very well at sort of coming back and trying to challenge each other. I think we need more of that. I thought Paul, you know, it's funny you start kind of getting into these discussions about sort of the role of the moderator. And I thought Paul did very well to interject and try to guide the conversation and not let it just turn into a free-for-all. These are very interesting little experiments in how to kind of have a discussion. And I don't know whether you ever come away thinking, oh, we had a really perfectly illuminating discussion. But I thought this one did very well to get at some of the major issues and some of the major differences. And now we have 10 more weeks to chew over it.
That was McLean's associate editor, Aaron Wary. Now, if you want more coverage of the McLean's leaders debate, McLean's magazine actually has a special tablet issue coming out with complete coverage from video and trending charts to regional impacts and even a behind-the-scenes look from moderator Paul Wells. Now, you can also stay tuned for our full episode of McLean's on the Hill, which will be out this weekend. We will be speaking with Paul Wells, get insight into the leaders' performances from a body language expert, and we'll find out from Facebook which leaders Canadians were talking about the most. That's it for this special edition of McLean's on the Hill. For more of your politics and power, stay tuned to the Hill.